Okay, this year is dedicated to Rachelea Bas Rav Chaim Tzvi. Okay, and let's get with it. What we're going to be talking about today is women and Purim. So this is going to be a two-part shiur. We're going to talk first about the theoretical and intellectual side of women and Purim, okay? And then we'll talk about practical things. So, by way of introduction, okay, we don't know Hashem. We don't know Hashem. We know what He wants through what He told us and through the world that He created. So, the truth is we don't really know each other or even ourselves that well. If I were to tell you that Shmuel HaNavi was a great man, and you never heard of Shmuel HaNavi, and you're somewhat skeptical, you'd say, well, what's so great about Shmuel HaNavi? Who was he? And I would have to tell you what he did and what he said. Meaning, I could tell you the outside of Shmuel HaNavi, because they reflect the inside. But do I know the inside of Shmuel HaNavi? Not really. And for most of us, we don't even know ourselves that well. So, the garments of the soul are thought, speech, action, but that's usually all we see. We don't really see the core self, even with ourselves, and certainly not with other people, and certainly not with Hashem. Okay, so the way Hashem chose to make Himself known, the way He lets Himself be addressed, is through His names. Hence, the word for His name, Shemo, is the same in Gematria, excuse me, as the word Ratzon, His will. So we know His will and we call Him by names. Okay, the Gemara tells us that the Torah itself was just like one long divine name. What does that mean? It means that every aspect of the Torah reflects Hashem's will in its own unique way. So the narratives have a way, and the halachic tests have another way. Okay, we have revealed, we have concealed, we have inner, we have outer dimensions of Hashem's will. So, in the creation narrative, it says that Hashem made man in His image. So, that means that there's something about us, the way we're constructed, that reflects the different aspects of Hashem's will that He brought into action in the process of creating the world. So, the same way then that Hashem makes His will known through the Torah and through the world, okay, we also have different means through which we make our will known, and they act as living allegories to what Hashem is and who He is. Meaning, the way we're constructed physically is a reflection of who we are on the inside, since our bodies are given to us so that we could let our will be done, and that in turn reflects something of Hashem. So that's introduction. So let's talk about hands and feet. Hands and feet, they're different ways which our will is done. Our hands do fine motor action, using the arms which do gross motor action. So we could do what we want. We could write, we could take, we could do. Our feet take us where we want to be. So the hands very much reveal our will in a way that's clearer and more open and accessible than our feet do. So let's look at an allegory from Shir HaShirim. We learned Shir HaShirim in these classes at one point, so for some of you this will be familiar. And for other of you, since this has like been a little while back, it'll be, what? We learned this? And for still others, it'll be Shir HaShirim? Okay. So in any case, in the narrative of Shir HaShirim, you have the great king who chooses a wife from the common people, and he elevates her and he brings her to his palace. And once she's there, she discovers life in the palace is not so easy. You have to be on all the time. You have to be mannerly. You have to look good. It's too hard for her. But she had no options. In the palace, there are no options. So as her life became more and more difficult, she felt less and less herself. She finally made a critical decision and she left. She went back to her native village. But something happened to her. What happened to her is that the effect upon her of living in the palace is that now she saw the villagers in a different light. They looked primitive, they looked coarse, they looked vulgar, because they were. They were primitive, coarse, and vulgar, but she never saw it before because she was enmeshed. She couldn't see them with any degree of objectivity. So she felt repulsed by them. So she didn't want to be in her village, but she also didn't want to be in the palace. And then something happened that made it worse still. The villagers picked up her feelings about them. She didn't overtly tell them anything, but they picked up her distance. They saw her refinement as snobbishness and rejection. So they began to hate her. They spat upon her, they persecuted her, they pulled her garments from her body. Until finally, the king comes to rescue her. So our narrative that's relevant for us, our purposes here in Megillah, is talking about the first attempt at rescue. So he knocks at her door, and she says, Pashatati et kutanta ech el beshena. She says, I've already taken my clothes off. I've gone to bed. Okay, I've washed my feet. How could I get them dirty by walking on the floor to open the door? So what does that mean? She didn't feel ready for him. She felt, again, we said, you only know somebody through their actions, through their outside, my garments. They're not the garments he wants to see. She didn't want to get up and open the door. It was too hard to redefine herself, to put on new garments at that point. It was too hard. She didn't open the door. He persisted. He knocked more. Finally, he left. Now, in those days, the way doors were constructed is that there was a hole, you know, like we have today, people. He tried to put his hand through to open the latch from the inside, and he withdrew his hand and left. She saw his hand. And she saw him leave, and she opened the door, but it was too late. He was gone. This is our part of the allegory in Shir HaShirim that's relevant. So the hand that reaches out, the revealed part of the will, is what she saw and what she yearns for. Okay, so one sort of relationship to Hashem is symbolized by the hand. Let's look at the legs. Also in Shir HaShirim. We use the allegory of the thigh. And there, again, we're talking about his desire for her and her thigh. It says, just like a thigh is hidden from view, we wear clothing. We don't see each other's thighs. We wear pants, dresses. Men wear pants, women wear dresses. Okay, so it's different. Torah is sometimes hidden from us. So we have nigla and nister, that which is hidden, that which is revealed. The hands which are revealed, the legs which are hidden. Okay, there are two approaches to Hashem. One is analogous to the hands, the other is analogous to the legs. The hands are the more clear and open way of doing Hashem's will. Learning Torah, bringing it into action, the hands. Let's talk about the legs. The legs are the part of the body, they're on the floor. They make contact with the earth, but they take the person where he wants to be. Okay, so the hands, the legs. Okay, the hands and the legs parallel. Okay, the way in which men and women are in their avodas Hashem. Men are like the hands. They receive, give. Women are like the feet, they bring Hashem into this world. So the question is, okay, why am I talking about this? the question is, Esther and Mordechai, who were they? Who was Esther, who was Mordechai in bringing about the great miracle of Purim? So Purim was primarily a victory, not only over Haman as a person, but a victory over Amalek and Avodah Zarah and everything that both of those two things sound like and really mean. What's Amalek? The source of doubt. Doubt comes from the physical world. Now, I want to explain this in more detail and more depth. Before the creation of the world, Hashem was infinite, had no limitations, and therefore no description. He began a process of reducing his presence availability, so to speak, by creating worlds. Okay, until finally he creates this world, which is a place in which even evil could exist. But forget about evil, just physicality. The voice of physicality says, I am. I am a desk, I am a piece of paper, I am a sweater. There's nothing about the physical world that necessarily tells us, just by looking, I'm a creation of God. So the earth, by its definition, is the place in which kfira, in which denial of God, is possible. So the feminine energy, the part that walks on the earth, comes in contact with Chumrius and tries to elevate it, is the force that's needed to overcome Avodah Zarah. So we have two energies here in the Purim story. Mordechai, who was very much out in the open. Imagine what it looked like when Mordechai didn't bow down to Haman. Do you ever see these pictures in National Geographic or elsewhere of Mecca, where you could see in the camera's lens tens of thousands of people all on the ground bowing before the Kaaba? Imagine Haman in that state, tens of thousands of people bowing before him, and Mordechai standing there, holding the shoe in which Haman had written his contract of servitude to Mordechai, that took place when they were both stuck in the desert. In the old days, when Mordechai was wandering back to Israel and Haman was in the Persian army, they were stuck together. Mordechai only agreed to give him food if Haman would sell himself as a slave. Imagine what that looked like. And then we see further, Mordechai declaring, no one should eat at Ahasuerus's Suda, which of course happened earlier in the Megillah, but that's a public announcement. Then further, Mordechai in the street, Se'akah, G'dolav, Mara, a great outcry, very public, in the streets, Berchov Ha'ir. Then you have again, Mordechai declaring fast, gathering the children, herds of children. Mordechai was very much the man of the public eye. Now let's look at Esther. Her very name, Esther. Okay, the question is, Esther min HaTorah minayin. Where do we have the hint at Esther? For, as you probably know, from where it says, Hastiras panay v'yamu, Hashem says, in exile, I'll conceal my face. Esther wanted nothing more than to hide from Ahasuerus's beauty contest police. Esther, who wanted to wear nothing unusual or beautiful or graceful when she went before Ahasuerus. Esther, whose moment of greatest heroism was one that the people never saw. When it says her greatest moment was Lubash Esther Malchut, Esther is enwrapped in Ruach HaKodesh, who saw it? This is before she even got Ahasuerus's glimpse. All of Esther's heroism took place inside. Her direct and deep confrontation with the forces of evil were hidden from the human eye, while Mordechai's confrontation with the forces of evil were completely in the open. So we have Nigla and Nister, that which is revealed, Mordechai, that which is hidden, Esther. So the question is, which force is more? So the purpose of the world, from the perspective, we see this in many Sfarim, Lukutei Amarim, Pitchei Sha'arim, the purpose of the world is to bring light to a dark place. Now I want you to do a mind game. Let's see three people. Me, an 8-year-old, and Arad. Now for those of you who don't know who Arad is, he's a chush of a baseball player. Okay, A. Rodriguez. Okay, so let's say we're all going to throw a ball as far as we could. First I throw a ball. Maybe 50 feet. Okay, the 8-year-old throws a ball. He'll do it overhand, he doesn't know better. Okay, maybe 20 feet. Then Arad throws the ball. Arad throws the ball as far as your eye could see. So the rule is the greater the strength, the further the expression of one's will, which in this case is the ball, the expression of strength can go. Hashem's infinite strength is most clear in the areas that are most distant from his essence. So this physical world is the place that displays his great, displays his presence with the greatest grandeur, because it's so far from what he is essentially. So lighting a candle in a dark place has more meaning than turning on the lights in a room that already has a light on. Esther had to turn the light. She had to be the candle in the dark place, not just turn it on. She had to be that. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you about now for a few minutes is what hardly anyone ever talks about. What happened to Esther after the Megillah? So when she went to Ahasuerus willingly, he took her that night. Wasn't the first time they were together. But this time, because she came to him and she had to at least show him the illusion of desiring him, as things were, she became pregnant. The child who she gave birth to was Darius II, Daryavish Sheni. So his mother is Jewish, his father is Ahasuerus, and he's a mamzer, because Esther is still married to Mordechai. That doesn't sound like a very happy ending, does it? So let's go back a few steps. After the defeat of Babylon through Darius I, the first Daryavish, is the one who killed Belshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar's son, at the famous banquet that led to the rise of the Persians and the Medes, to the ascent of Ahasuerus. Okay. Koresh, the great prince of Persia, gave the Jews permission to go back and build the Beis HaMikdash, which Ahasuerus rescinded. Esther's son, Darius II, okay, allowed the Jews to go back. He reinstated the permission that they had. And there were stops and starts, but he let them do it. Wasn't even Jewish. I want to compare with you for the moment the first and second Batei Mikdash. The first Beis HaMikdash was compared to the sun, the second to the moon. The first Beis HaMikdash was glorious. It was a place of enormous spiritual illumination, in a way that you could see it easily, almost visually. There were constant miracles. There was the Aron, there was, you know, the Urim V'Tumim, the light, the perfection. Okay? And then it was all destroyed. The second Beis HaMikdash was very, very different in every respect. Let's again look, go back for a moment to look at the first Beis HaMikdash. Who built it? Shlomo, who was a living parable of Hashem's Malchus, of Hashem's kingship in the higher realms. David, who's a single soul with Adam and Mashiach, dug the foundations. The doors opened in his merit. Su'ushar Moshechem, okay, the gates wouldn't open until Shlomo said, Bavur David Avdecha, Al Teshev Pnei Mashiachecha. So that's who built it. That's who began it. That's who completed it. Goyim brought about the building of the second temple. The Persians, their authority, and to some degree even their money. It's a vast difference. The second temple had none of the miracles. The second temple had none of the grandeur of the first temple. So let's look back at these two temples a little bit more. The first temple was built in Avram's merit. Avram was compared to the sun. He brought light into the world. And in fact, he had an amulet that he wore around his neck. People could look at it and be healed. It says that amulet was like the sun that bears healing on its wings, to quote Tehillim. Not Tehillim. Oops, okay, I have to remember where the pasuk that speaks about healing on the wings of the sun comes from. It's not Tehillim. Yitzchak was completely different. He was the Amot HaAvoda. He was the pillar of prayer. Prayer is an internal reality. There's no fanfare. There's nothing sun-like. The second temple was Yitzchak. Everything was on the inside. Very little was on the outside. The third temple that has yet to be built will be a mixture of them both, like Yaakov, the most perfect of either of them, with components of both. So Bayit Sheni was like Yitzchak. Bayit Rishon was like Avraham. Bayit Rishon was like the sun. Bayit Sheni was like the moon. Let's go back and talk a moment about the relationship of the sun and the moon. So we all know the story in the Bereishis narrative, where at first in the text, the two luminaries are referred to as the great luminaries. And then we talk about the great one and the small one. Now, how'd that happen? So you're probably familiar with the story. The moon complains and says, two kings can't rule with one crown. And God says, you're right, and reduces the size and scope of the moon. Okay, so when you read this story superficially, you think, okay, the moon got what she deserved. Like, she shouldn't have been, okay, whatever. Much deeper level. The moon purposely said that because it's true. And she was willing to make herself smaller to demonstrate that there's only one crown that belongs to one king, which ultimately is Hashem. So what that means concretely is that the result of that is that there are two ways of serving Hashem. Yadayim v'raglayim. Yadayim, what's out there, what's visible. Raglayim, what touches the earth, but its power, the thighs, are concealed. To us, the trait of raglayim, which is called malchus, making Hashem rule, not me, Hashem. Malchut always is less attractive to us than chachma, the brilliance of knowing, the brilliance of illumination. Later in the Torah, we find that when the sacrificial offerings are narrated, that when the Rosh Chodesh offering is described, part of the offering was a sin offering. It says, and my sin offering. My sin offering? Who's doing the talking, Hashem? What does that mean? So on a simple level, what that means is Hashem is saying that, like all of the other offerings, it's dedicated to me. Any offering has to be dedicated to Hashem. On a deeper level, Rashi quotes the Talmud as saying that Hashem, so to speak, obviously this is in parable, is saying, I owe you a sin offering. When I allow the moon to be diminished, okay, the effect was a disaster. Now, what does that mean? So surely, who did Hashem sin against? Himself? What does that mean? No. What it means is that by allowing us to think that that which is done hiddenly, and that which involves conscious contact with the earth, and selflessness, is somehow less big, less attractive, less real than that which shines, that led to countless tragedies in Avodas Hashem, where we end up being a people at times who are all generals and no subjects. You know the Jewish joke on that. So this is a true story, by the way. I shouldn't have called it a Jewish joke. When the State of Israel was founded, the president, Chaim Weizmann, went to Harry Truman. And Harry Truman congratulated him, you know, being the first president of the Jewish state. He says, how does it feel to be president? And he says, it's hard. You can't possibly know what it is. So Truman said, what do you mean I didn't know what it is? I'm also president. He says, no. Now, the populations in both places were different then. I'm president of 186 million Americans. You're president of 186 million Americans. I'm president of a million presidents. Now, this is true. This is how we are. So the diminishment of Malchus is a terrible tragedy because the world was meant to be a place where its candle, its brilliance is seen dafka, where it's darker. Thus it says, in the ultimate future, the light of the moon will be as bright as the light of the sun. Why am I telling you this business about the moon and the sun? What does this have to do with it, with Megillah? It has everything to do with Megillah. Esther's son, Dayavish, brought about the building of the second temple. That that changes the whole story. It's a radical change. Open your mind to this change. Which temple was holier in essence, the first temple or the second temple? If you're looking superficially, of course the first temple was holier. If you're looking in terms of what the world was created to be and do, of course the second temple was holier. How so? How do you see these two visions flesh out? So the first temple, again, glory, open miracles. Of course it's more. That's the sun. That's Avraham. And the world was created for him, don't forget. It says, Behi Baram Ba'Avraham. Same letters. Second temple. No Ruach HaKodesh, no Aro, no Urim V'Tumim, no Nisim. So he had to reach Hashem and see his brilliance and luminescence without there being any light from the outside. The light had to come from the inside. Our hearts had to be our menorah in this sense, although they had a menorah. So what's that? That's holier. That's Yitzchak, who was a step beyond Avraham. So notice, I'm not saying Yitzchak was the greater of the two individuals, because he began where Avraham left off. He needed Avraham to be Yitzchak. But it's a greater temple. So what that's telling us is as follows. The sun and the moon are compared also to Moshe and Yehoshua. Moshe was the sun, Yeshua was the recipient. Their relationship was considered to be, by way of allegory, like a husband who provides and a wife who receives and builds. So it was Yehoshua who took the Jews into Eretz Yisrael. And Moshe led the Jews when they were in fantasy land, so to speak, in the desert, where everything was brilliant, where there were Nisim every day, where there were clouds of glory, where there was man, there were a will that traveled with them. He was with them in the world of revelation. Yehoshua was with them in the world of concrete reality, a world in which you had to plant fields, wage wars, settle a house. In Yehoshua's time, talking about where's the spring, how many cattle could be raised on this plot of land, they were the relevant questions. Okay, that's the mentality of Eretz Yisrael. The mentality of Eretz Yisrael, the mochen of Eretz Yisrael, is bringing light to an inherently dark place. And this is what we're created for. There's a pasuk that says, L'hanchil olam yesh. Hashem created the world so we can inherit it. We could inherit what? Olam haba, that which is, that which is eternal. The word yesh in gematria is 310. So concerning this, Gemara says that each tzaddik in olam haba gets 310 olamot. What's this about? What are you talking about? 310 is the maximization of the number 31. In order to gain Eretz Yisrael, the Jews had to do battle against 31 kings, each of one of whom had his own take on evil. So the reward for doing battle with the forces of evil is what Olam Haba comes from. Olam Haba doesn't come from hanging around and saying Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. That gives us Dveikus, but it doesn't give us Olam Haba. Olam Haba comes from putting light in Dafka, a dark place. Energy is compared to the sun. Feminine energy is compared to the moon. So from that perspective, the Purim story is very much a mixture of both, with Esther's role being at least as essential as Mordechai's. Her innerness, her Ruach HaKodesh, her ability to be the living reality, the reflected Shekhinah Begaluta, the Shekhinah in exile, was what Purim was about. So I want to take you back a minute. Esther was in the palace 9 years before Haman was elevated. During all of this time, what did she eat? She ate fruit. She was the Shekhinah, the embodiment of Hashem's presence, Begaluta, in a black exile. And then it got worse. didn't get better, it got worse. She has to present herself to Ahasuerus. She has a child with him. What could be deeper Galus HaShechina than that? Could you imagine a worse situation than that in life? So therefore, in B'nai Yisachar, he asks the question, why did Mordechai tell Esther to go into Ahasuerus? If he's going to use prayer as a weapon, why didn't he gather everyone together and have them pray that Ahasuerus dies? Now that would be a much better solution for everything. If Ahasuerus died, then the fact that Haman had authority from him would be meaningless. He would have the authority of a dead king. So, and there'd be someone else. Who says that somebody else will elevate Haman? And that would free Esther. Seems like the perfect solution. But Mordechai knew, it says in the Megillah, and Mordechai knew everything that was done. And Esther knew that Mordechai knew. This is why when he said that the terrible decrees were made against the Jews, she said, Maza v'yal maza, what is it and what's it about? She knew he knew what it's about. Mordechai knew that the final tikkun had not yet taken place. That the attachment that we had to idol worship and to superficiality was not yet totally rectified. How so? So we just said the physical world has one statement. What is that? I am. What's physical looks bigger and more real to us even now than things that are spiritual. So often what we know, for instance, that Hashem is in control of everything, and what we see are on two different pages. So I want to illustrate this concretely. I had a conversation with a girl today. She's a student at Neve. She has a hard roommate. The girl who isn't a bad person, but she's self-absorbed, she can come in at 1 a.m, turn the lights on, wake up her roommates, and she'll apologize, but she'll do it again next time she's out late. And she makes a lot of noise, and, with her tape recorder, and she's a mess, her stuff's all over the room. It's not a huge room, it's a dorm room. So the girl who came to me had first gone to the house mother of her building and told her all of this and asked her to please perhaps provide the girl a new place to live, not her room. And the house mothers had tried to work it out with each other. Bottom line, nothing happened. The other girl didn't become more considerate, and our heroine, well, called Evelyn, didn't find it easier to tolerate, and nobody's moving. She went to the educational director of Neve, Rabbi Shalkovsky, and he has a rule, because he believes strongly, as do I in this regard, that one of the primary areas of growth is learning to live with people. So he has an ironclad rule, which is, if you can't get along with your roommate, you have to move. Your job is to get along with your roommate, to find a basis of communication with her, to make it possible to make compromises and to live in a way that's decent and loving with another human being. She doesn't want to move. So she came to me today. It was her last-ditch hope. She thought erroneously that I had more authority than I really do, and told me the whole story. And she ended, I was shocked with how she ended the story. So I said, so what are you doing, Evelyn? So she says, I'm making the other girl, let's call her Serena, which isn't her name, I'm making Serena miserable so she'll ask to move, because I have no choice. You know, like I'm ignoring her when I bring my friends into the room, like I tell them before not to talk to, not that they shouldn't talk to her. Okay, this is what's happening. And I want to tell, nobody in this story is 18. These are young women. What's wrong with her equation? There's a problem here. What's the problem? If I were to ask her intellectually, are you put here in the world to reject your fellow Jew overtly? She would say no, she's not stupid. She knows that that's the truth. If I were to ask her, would you want someone to treat you the way you're treating Serena? She would say no. If I were to ask her whether what she's doing is what the great tzaddikim would do, she would say no. She knows the right answers. I didn't ask her those questions yet. I'm letting her cool a day. But I will. I don't know if that's going to change anything, and I want to tell you why. Because when the light goes on, it's here now and physical. You understand this? So what we know intellectually doesn't always change the way we perceive reality physically. So intellectually we know this is transient. In a year from now, the light being on won't matter. You'll turn over and you'll go back to sleep. It won't matter. But now, it seems bigger than life. Now it seems icker. It seems like the most important thing. When in fact, she's neck deep in the Nisayon. She's like Nachshon. She's in the sea. And she has to ask Hashem for help here, because Baal Mayim Ad Nafes, she needs Siyata Deshmaya, not just resolution to get through this. So why am I telling you this? The Jews didn't recover from that mentality. That's why back in Nebuchadnezzar's time, they bowed down to Nebuchadnezzar. Why? Because he decreed death against anybody who wouldn't. Now, if the whole nation didn't bow, would they all die? Probably not. But the threat scared them to the point that they bowed, which I understand totally. Okay, there was a chance at rectification at the Sa'uda. Which will they see as being more vivid? The Sa'uda itself, or the desecration and the Chilul Hashem of Ahasuerus serving in big day kahuna in the Kohen's clothing with vessels of the Beis HaMikdash? The Sa'uda itself was more vivid. And they were given another chance with Haman coming to power. And there the Nisayon was easier because they didn't have to go out to bow to him. It was only if they were out they had to bow to him. They could have chosen to stay home. But they didn't, because you have to go here and you have to go there. How long could you stay in the apartment? So the same failures were there. Did they do tshuva? Yes. They did tshuva. There's no question about it. And tshuva me'ahava. Tshuva that was coming from deep love of Hashem. And they accepted the restrictions of Torah and its ways of connecting with greater dvekas than they had even at Mount Sinai. There were great changes that left an imprint. What was the imprint that will be able to really bring light to a dark place? If we don't fail, if we don't succeed every time, we'll succeed a lot of the time. And the proof is that we still exist after 2,000 years of exile. In order for that imprint to be real, Esther had to spend the rest of her time in Ahasuerus's palace to be a living example of bringing light to a dark place. A living example, not of doing something that could be described easily. We don't have a Megillah talking about Esther's next chapter. It's all within her, maintaining her own inner integrity in that place. Elevating the nitzotot of Kedusha, the sparks of holiness that could be elevated in that place. That's who Esther was, and this is why she's such a great heroine. Okay, so now let's be concrete. Remember I told you that we'll make this concretized. So let's look at the mitzvot of Purim. The first is Kriyas HaMegillah. So in fact, Chazal say that Esther and Mordechai did different parts of the instituted different aspects of the halachot that we keep, that the Megillah itself is called Megillat Esther, not Megillat Mordechai ve'Esther. Because why? Because these were her words. She saw Hashem when he's least revealed. So that means women are obligated to hear Megillah. Obligated, because this is our voice, even though we're not obligated towards learning Torah. So when you go to hear the Megillah, where should you be at? Be Esther. Be Esther bringing holiness to the Gashmi world, the world in which Hashem is concealed, which is where women function most of the time. The world of shopping and cleaning and this and that. And wherever it says HaMelech, not Melech HaChashverosh, HaMelech, you know what you should try to feel? The same awe, the same inner trembling that when you hear HaMelech on Rosh Hashanah. Only there it's Benigla, it's Yadayim. And here it's Benistar, it's Raglayim. That's where you should be when you hear Megillah, ideally. So I want to tell you an interesting Gemara. Okay, Mordechai initially wanted to make Purim different than it is. He wanted Purim to be like a Yom Tov, with an Isser Malacha, where you can't do work and all of that. Esther didn't, and it is as it is. because she saw feasting and involvement in the world and still being holy as the ikar of Purim. That's really making Hashem Melech. When he's the king who could be there in the midst of his concealment, where you could say, Achein, ata kel mistater, indeed, you're a hidden God. This is what Purim is about. So this is what we have to take with us when we hear Megillah. For every situation that we face in life in which there's concealment, and as women we have the kochos to deal with this, we can reflect Hashem's light and make him melech. And we'll notice also that there was vina hafachu. The whole Megillah is about vina hafach, that the salvation that didn't come about at Achashverosh's Su'uda will come about through our meals, through our elevated gashmias that we serve in our meals to Kedusha. But there's a condition. Remember I said we'd get practical? It's so easy to be distracted. You make a menu. Open up Bina magazine and then commit suicide. No, not really. Okay, you know, you make a menu. It should be beautiful. It should be elegant. It should be ample. Okay, you could get so involved in making the meal that you forget that this is supposed to be a meal of hoda'ah, a meal of thanking Hashem, and not showing off your own culinary skill. It should be a time of gratitude towards Hashem, not a time of stress, not a time of craziness. So the su'uda has to be done with kavana to make Hashem rule. And if that means making a simpler meal, but still ample and still nice, so make it simpler. Okay. Next, kal v'chomer the mishloach manos. I saw in an article in Modia that I'm not sure if it was Modia. It was either in Modia or one of the Hebrew publications. I read English Modia. It might have been one of the Hebrew publications, that the Satmar Rebbe has told his community to stop buying Mishloach Manos and rather to send simple homemade Mishloach Manos. And then whoever put together the article, the reporter, wrote almost parenthetically that store-bought Mishloach Manos, I would imagine that means in the area in which his community lives, tend to run from $20 to $50. Mm-hmm. Now, in Israel, they don't cost anywhere near that amount necessarily, but even here, every year, they're getting fancier. I remember when it was respectable to send Mishloach Manos, which would be a slice of homemade cake, and a nice piece of fruit, and some goodies, a piece of chocolate, a lollipops, it depends if they're children or not children, a small jar of tahina on a plate. And you would take back the plate. This is not prehistory. I remember this. I remember that we all got into paper plates, which was, came later to Israel than it did to the States. And then cellophane. That first was the paper plate and the napkin. Then there's cellophane. Now, it's all very elaborate. It's very beautiful. And it doesn't cost between $20 and $50. I would say it costs between 50 and 100 shekel to get a nice-looking bor shalach manas. But who needs this? What's Mishloach Manot about? So Mishloach Manot don't necessarily have to be sent to the needy. They should be sent as a gift of friendship to make us all feel one with each other. So feeling one is the opposite of being competitive. You can't feel I'm her and she's me if we're competing with each other. So whatever your budget, I'm not telling you to go back to an apple and a piece of cake because many people would see that as insulting if they were to receive it. But whatever could be a non-competitive gift of love is where we want to go. And you don't have to necessarily send a package to the immediate world, the immediate planet. You could send it to people who are in need of somebody telling them, I love you, I remember you, I care for you. There are people who are overwhelmed and overloaded with Mishloach Manos. Maybe they could not have your Mishloach Manos or have a simpler one. So we have the Kriyas HaMegillah, Mishloach Manot, the Su'uda, Matanas Le'Evyonim. What does Rambam say about Matanas Le'Evyonim? Matanas Le'Evyonim means gifts to the poor. Being poor means that you're in a dark place. Let no one ever romanticize poverty to you. There's a vast difference between simplicity and poverty. Simplicity is, by definition, as I use it, is a choice. Poverty is the consequence of inability to get what you want. Poverty means making choices that are not good choices. Having to choose between dental work and bus tickets is not a good choice. Having to choose between being honest enough to repay the gemach or leaving your apartment is not a good choice. Poverty is darkness. When you give matanas levyonim, you're living out Purim in the ultimate sense. You're bringing light to a dark place. So therefore, Rambam says, of all of the mitzvahs hayom that cost money, the seuda, the mishloach manos, spend your money on matanas levyonim. Ideally, I'm not saying this is halacha, ideally see that the amount that you give out in matanas levyonim more than equals what you spend on mishloach manos and on the seuda. Find the avyonim, or make them part of your seuda, even better. And what you're going to see is that there's enormous joy in bringing light to a dark place. There's enormous simcha that you can never feel when you feel when you're bringing light to a light place. The simcha of Purim is the simcha of feeling I've liberated myself, we're free, it's happened, we're redeemed. And indeed, Pesach laid the foundation for Geula. Purim is its actualization. We could take Hashem's love that he demonstrated on Pesach and actualize it on Purim by showing love for each other and higher consciousness towards him. Thus, in Torah language, Pesach is the first month, which is the plan, and Purim is the 11th month, the culmination of the plan, the fulfillment. Okay? So we should have a joyous Purim, the month of Hatzaras HaSfekas, the month where no matter what the darkness is, we see light anyway, the month in which we could say, there's no difference, Limala, between the Nisyonos that are hard and the Nisyonos that are easy, between Baruch Mordechai and Arur Haman. Have a great Purim.